This is Sarah Stewart Holland.
And this is Beth Silvers. Thank you for joining us for Pantsuit Politics.
Welcome to a special episode of Pantsuit Politics. This is Maggie. I'm the Director of Community Engagement here at Pantsuit Politics. And today we're sharing a community favorite from the second quarter of 2023 as we continue our look back on the best of the year. Today's conversation, Why the Modern Male is Struggling with Richard Reeves, originally aired in June and was one of our most popular episodes of the whole year. Richard Reeves is a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institute and leads the Boys and Men Project. His research focuses on boys, men, inequality, and social mobility. In 2022, he published his book of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters, and What to Do About It. 2023 has been called the Year of the Girl. We've talked on this podcast about Barbie, the Taylor Swift Eras Tour, and Beyoncé's Renaissance. And I'm not even scratching the surface of the women in art, music, and politics that have had a truly incredible year. But when I look through my life, I see two distinct eras. I have three siblings who are all girls. I have two daughters. I grew up with a beautiful community of aunts, bonus moms, strong women in my life, and a wonderful father who supported my mom's career and showed up for me by taking me to school, fixing lunches, putting up ponytails, coaching soccer teams, and helping me believe that I could be whatever I wanted to in my life. When I got married, I married a man who is one of three boys, and he has kind of pulled me into a much more stereotypically masculine world. He practices and teaches martial arts, and together we own a martial arts studio. And with that studio has come a steady stream of little boys into my life who have changed how I think of boys and masculinity. I have observed so many of the trends that Reeves names. Boys being labeled as disruptive, being often rightly diagnosed with ADHD, but struggling to see themselves as good kids because our education system seems like it's not built for them to succeed. Richard Reeves names so many problems that men struggle with, meaning, identity, and mental health, and seeks to acknowledge and address them without taking anything away from the hard-earned struggles for women's rights and equality. As with so many issues, Reeves's work points to an idea that making school, family, and work better for modern men could also make things better for women, children, teens, the labor shortage, and more. We hope that you enjoy hearing this episode again, that maybe you hear something you didn't hear before, think about it in a new way, and that you have the very best holiday season available to you. I look forward to being back with you with new episodes and conversations in the new year. Without further ado, here is Sarah's conversation with Richard Reeves.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Mine is at about 50%, and I'll tell you why. I have a tendency to overcommit. I want to help with everything I can possibly help with. I want to do everything I can possibly do. I want to be with people, and I forget that at the end of the day, I am an introvert, and I really need time to recharge and take care of myself. Therapy gives me important tools to do that, to recognize what's going on, to understand my battery and where it is and why it's there and what I can do to recharge. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/pantsuit today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/pantsuit. episode that I do not like to spend my time or money in salons when I can help it, but I do enjoy a good manicure, and I especially enjoy spending time with my daughters doing the Olive and June Mani system at home, because we can all get a good-looking manicure for around $2. We know that the polish won't chip and will last at least a full week. We get to await with anticipation the new colors that come out each season. The girls love being able to add some sparkles or choose whether they want their top coat to be matte or shiny. We just have a really good time together with salon-grade tools that are so easily explained so that we can do a really good job taking care of our nails, but do it all from the comfort at home. All the choices of a big salon stored in a basket in my closet for when we're ready to hang out together. The Olive and June Mani system is a real game changer. So visit oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first Mani system.
Richard Reeves, welcome to Pantsuit Politics.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much for writing this book. Now, you might not know this if Fred, our mutual friend at Brookings, didn't warn you. I cry a lot on this podcast, so I might tear up a little bit when I thank you for writing this book as the mother of three boys. Like, it was incredibly valuable to me. At this point, our audience might already be tired of hearing about this book because I talk about it so much. But it really, really was helpful to me in naming a lot of things I felt like I saw. And I know that that's how this book started for you, was not as a policy wonk, but was as a, we share this in common, you are the father of three boys.
Right. I have this view that all scholarship is at least a little bit autobiographical. Like, why do you end up studying that subject?
All good scholarship.
I think so. Yeah. And then some scholars will sort of pretend that somehow this subject area or they could just sort of dropped on them through, you know, from on high. And that's not true. It's something about it is intertwined with your personality. And in this case, it was so obvious that looking at the world through my son's eyes, they're all in their 20s now, and I've raised them in the UK and the US. It just was an education for me. And made me reflect a lot more on my own experience. And I think it was partly because of that that I started just looking more at the data. So I tend to say, well, I wonder what the gender split on that is, or how are boys doing on that measure, or have you broken that by gender? And that then led me to a lot of the data points that sort of empirically underpin the book. But I agree that there's no hard line here between empiricism and emotion. Mm. And I think it's just, you just have to be hands above the table about that and say, look, here's where I'm coming from. So people don't, I think if you've got some sort of autobiographical element to your work and you're not upfront about it, then people will always wonder. So yep. I'm hands above the table. Yeah, I'm worried about my boys. They're all doing great, fortunately. But the world that they're in is so different, mm-hmm. even to the world I was in, let alone my father, that it's right. astonishing.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I was a women's studies minor. Like, I came out of this. I'm an only girl. I'm an only child. And so I had a very defined worldview about how I thought gender worked in the world. And then I had these three boys. And fun fact, my first son, they told me, was a girl in two different ultrasounds. So I already had this sort of
We had that with one of ours. It's yeah. weird, isn't it? We had exactly yeah. the same thing.
Two
We'd actually named him. He was going to be Gabby.
Love it. Had a shower, got some dresses. And I'll be honest, I had a lot of disappointment. I wanted a girl because I thought I knew what that meant. I thought I knew what that looked like. And it was very intimidating to me, I think, because probably subconsciously I had already observed some of these things of the difficulties of raising boys. And I think I had what you named very early, which is we individualize the problems with boys and we systemize the problems we see with girls. Tell us how you sort of started to name that.
Yeah, I observed that, and I observed it across the political spectrum. This is not a left-right thing, which is there was a reflexive tendency to say, if a boy is struggling or a man is struggling, to say, well, kind of, well what's wrong with him to mm-hmm. some extent, right? You know, he's lazy, he's got ADD, he's, you know, whatever. And it doesn't have to be, you know, the level of judgment is applied differently. And I guess for those on the left, it tended to be more about, will almost to treat boys as defective girls.
Yes.
And to just say, like, why can't you be more like your sister? Like, why are you so restless? Why can't you focus? Why can't you plan? Why don't you think about the future? And there are good biological reasons for those differences. But nonetheless, it was all about, like, what's wrong with my son? Like, why is he struggling in school? Why is the school not serving my son very well? And then on the other side of the aisle, there has been a tendency in recent years to sort of say, well, men are being emasculated. The problem is they're not masculine enough and that they just need to kind of man up again and be real men again. And that will be the solution. But what they share beneath those very stark differences, they do share an individualistic notion of the problem, right? The problem is of men to be, we need to fix men one at a time. And either they're too masculine or not masculine enough, depending on who you're talking to. But there wasn't enough attention to questions like, is the education system working for men? Has the labor market become less friendly to men? Is our system of family law one that's being fair to fathers as well as to mothers, et cetera? Those are much more boring questions, but they are about structures and laws and policies. And especially on the left, there's a tendency to look for structural problems, right? I think it's one of the things that comes instinctively to people on the center left, but with one exception, which is when it comes to boys and men.
Yeah. And I think it's so heartbreaking. We had an expert in mental health, a listener to our show, and she was talking about how boys are punished with therapy. Like, there's something wrong with you, so we need to go to therapy because you're not focusing and because you're too hyper. And, you know, what I think you name so beautifully, and I was thinking about this when this last teen health, mental health survey came out, which is, especially when we're going to start talking about the education system and how girls and boys operate inside of it, we're just really talking about two different problems, because the teen girls are also not okay within that system. That's what we saw in that survey. And I think it's so tempting to say, well, we just want them to get good grades and then they'll thrive inside the education system and that'll fix it. But I think you see further out in higher education, it's more complicated than that. And you definitely see it when the girls who are, quote unquote, succeeding inside the education system just come down with a whole other set of mental health challenges. It's like, you guys, we need to go back to the drawing room. Like, this is the way we individualize this, I think, just presents in different kinds of mental health challenges, particularly when you're talking about the education system and teenagers.
Yeah. So I agree with the way you frame that, which is that they're young men and young women, boys and girls, are struggling in different ways and to some extent for different reasons. But what's interesting, and if you look at the work of Jonathan Haidt, and he has just a great new Substack out actually on this, on why it's particularly liberal girls who are really seeing this kind of spike in mental health problems, and interestingly, liberal boys as well. And that's something I'm very interested in digging further into. But when we're looking at, like, what's happening with the girls with this incredible spike, for example, in self-reported sadness and so on, I mean, just it's like a 10 percentage point jump in 2 years, following an 8 percentage point jump. So it's gone up by something like from 40% to 57% in 4 years of girls who are incapacitated for at least 2 years by these feelings. And so, okay, so what happened, right, over that time period? And I'm pretty convinced by the evidence that social media does have a big part to play here, not least because girls consume social media very differently to boys. They are the ones who are on TikTok, Instagram, et cetera. They relate to that. There's much more. Social media can be weaponized against girls in a way that's very different against boys. And so there's all this discussion now in Congress about age of consent, regulating social media. And so we're immediately saying, look, what is it about our environment? What is it about our culture, our system, not the school system where the girls seem to be doing okay in terms of grades, but like our culture? Like, how is it? What are we doing? What are we doing to these girls that's making them feel this way? That's our instinctive, reflexive way of thinking about it, to look for reasons why they're suffering.
Yep.
I think that's the right reflex. But we don't always do that with boys. We don't always say, look, the boys are really suffering. So including among high school age boys, 4 times more likely to commit suicide than girls, failing on all kinds of measures of education, massive friendship recession among boys, much more isolation, obviously kind of potential issues around addiction to different kinds of technology, including pornography and video games, etc. So it's playing out differently. But sometimes there's a tendency to say, what are we doing to our girls to make them feel this way? Mm. And then to say, what's wrong with our boys that they feel this way? If they weren't so toxic and they weren't bottling up their feelings so much and they could just learn to express themselves, etc., they'd be okay. And so even in that sort of teen mental health crisis space, I see an asymmetry in our instinctive reaction to it, right? And there's this old saying that kind of, you know, when girls are struggling, there's something wrong with society. When boys are struggling, there's something wrong with boys.
Yeah.
And I still think we're a bit stuck in that mindset.
No, I totally agree. I thought your point about, we talk about toxic masculinity, but we don't talk about toxic femininity. Although I'm happy to report on a Facebook post yesterday, I had a friend of mine use the term toxic femininity to describe, the Will Smith, Jada Pinkett Smith, and Chris Rock. She was saying like this idea, and I want to get into this about particularly gendered racial discrimination. She kind of described her reaction, this idea like you can never do anything wrong is toxic femininity and to like claim victimhood. And I thought, and this is a Black woman who made this post, and I thought, that is not what I expected to see today on Facebook, but I think it's a move in the right direction. Like to say, like, there are toxic aspects of femininity. And I think we do this thing of like, well, that means you're criticizing being a woman. And we think, well, we have this whole history of discrimination. We can't do that. We're opening it up to the people who have, you know, traditionally been discriminated against, and we're creating more ways for them to be discriminated against. And so there is this orientation, I think, particularly among the left, that perpetuates that reaction in ways, and we're missing things, some really obvious things when it comes to the education system. You know, you argue in your book pretty convincingly that at the very least we should start boys later. I have a lot of regret about not holding my middle son back. He was born in June. But in my mind, it's because redshirting was like this perpetuation of toxic masculinity. We're holding them back because they can play sports better. That was what I understood redshirting to be. Right?
Because you were thinking about athletic redshirting as opposed to academic.
That was the orientation, right? And so in my mind, I was like avoiding toxic masculinity by like putting him in school and letting him go. And now I'm like, man, he's so young. He's just so young.
Yeah, well, we had a similar regret with our middle son, where we sort of half started him late. It was, you know, it was the worst of all worlds, where we started him halfway through the year because we couldn't get this school to agree, and my wife and I weren't in full agreement about it. And it's one of my big regrets that we should have just gone all the way, because that in some ways may have been the worst of all worlds. And again, he was June baby, pretty young for his year, and just wasn't ready. And just all, you know, all our instincts, and especially my wife's instincts, were like, no, he's just not ready. And the system, and to some extent me, were just like, well, this is just how it works, right? I actually really dislike the term toxic masculinity, and I think rather than start to say, okay, so there also can be toxic femininity, it's true that we don't use that it's just to get away from this idea of toxicity altogether.
Yes, you're right.
Because it's just, I think a better way to, so I sometimes talk about mature masculinity as opposed to immature masculinity or whatever. And the way I think about this is that there are certain traits and attributes, ways of being in the world, that on average are more associated with men than with women. Of course, the distributions overlap, right? So the average doesn't mean that all women are like this and all men are like that. But there are some differences, like risk-taking, sex drive, potential for aggression, people versus things, etc. And they overlap to different degrees. But I think rather than saying like there's something about each of those traits could either be a good or a bad thing, depending on how it's expressed, depending on whether it's balanced by other traits, right? So the tendency of women to be more agreeable, for example, in other words, to care a bit more what people think about them, to be more attentive to people's emotional reactions to them, to be less likely to want to upset people and offend them and so on, right? Women are a little bit higher on that personality trait on average, right? Is that a good or a bad thing? Now, it sounds like a good thing, but actually, if you're too agreeable, you never state what you want. You never actually push yourself out in the world. And actually not upsetting someone is more important than getting justice from someone, et cetera, and vice versa. And so same with men and risk, right? Is it good or bad that boys and men have a higher appetite tendency towards risk? Is that good? Yes. Is it bad? Yes. It depends, right? And so rather than saying these things are intrinsically good or bad, the real conversation is how do we find ways to express them in ways that are kind of more pro-social than others, rather than trying how to somehow, I don't know, have a sort of rite of exorcism where we can sort of suck all the masculinity out of the men. And we don't tend to do that for femininity. We don't tend to say femininity is bad. What we tend to do is to say, look, it shouldn't be determinative. It shouldn't, and you shouldn't treat women differently just because they're more like this, right? And there are plenty of women who don't fit that mold. But I actually think one of the great triumphs of the women's movement was actually to pursue feminism without destroying femininity, without saying femininity is the problem. Now, there were moments, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. How old are you? Is it rude to ask how old you are before?
No, not at all. I'm 41.
Okay. So I'm trying to think whether you can remember the 80s, but a little bit, right? But you probably never had to wear shoulder pads. So.
No, I was too young. But yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. In the ties, the limp ties, yes, of the blouse. Yes.
And so there was this period women had to wear, they literally weren't allowed to look like women. Yeah. Right. They had to do assertiveness training. So they've kind of, et cetera, et cetera. And so there was this risk for a period that in order to get equality, women were basically going to have to become quasi men, or at least pretend. And then enough women just went, no, I'm not doing that. So I don't want to be like them. I want to be like me, but I also want to be able to do that job. Right.
Right.
Which was exactly the right impulse. And so we've managed to honor femininity without that becoming in any way an obstacle to women's progress. We need to, I think, pay the same courtesy to men and to masculinity.
Well, one of the most helpful things I read, you know, in my parenting journey, really trying to think through the benefits of both approaches, masculine and feminine approaches, was Jennifer Senior's book, All Joy, No Fun. And she talks about, like, yeah, the men are less invested and the women could learn from that. Like, they could take some of the pressure off themselves by watching the fathers and saying, they don't care. And maybe I shouldn't either. Maybe everything isn't the end of the world when it comes to this child. Like, let's ease some of the pressure on that. And I've learned that from my husband for sure. And I think that balance where you're saying, like, we're not trying to elevate one, we're not trying to eliminate the other, we're acknowledging the inherent strengths. And it's that self-awareness that I think is really valuable. And we need more cultural conversation when it comes to masculinity. You know, one time we were in Michigan and on this port, and there was a big warning sign about the tide, and there were two boys that had died. And I pulled mine over and I said, what do these two people have in common? And they're like, they're teenage boys. And I said, right. So I want you to be aware of that instinct. I don't want you to quash it. That's why we're in Boy Scouts. I think Boy Scouts is an excellent way to channel that need to do some risk, to go out there, to like sleep in the dark by yourself. I don't care. But like, I want you to be aware of that, you know, in the same way that if I had daughters, I would say, hey, be aware of that need to please. Be aware of that desire.
Yes.
To be liked, right? So let's own that. Let's just be aware of it.
Yep. And be aware of it and recognize them, particularly on something like social media. Like, that's why this social media stuff has been so brutal for girls, I think, because it does tap into that, you know, the psychology of being liked and shamed and mean girls and best friend and stuff. So I agree. And I think that's why, A, it was a historic mistake for the Boy Scouts to go co-ed and rebrand themselves BSA. We still have Girl Scouts, by the way, as a separate girl-only organization, but actually Boy Scouts has gone co-ed. But also, I agree, that's a great example of the risk thing. And on a personal level, like, I became a scout leader and went away to do some training. I was also in scouts all the way through, and this moment in the training really stuck with me, which was like, look, we do all this training before we go hiking and do all this and mountaineering and stuff, and then they told us these stories of these scouts that had died, right, mountaineering or doing all these things, and they're basically saying, look, the leaders did everything right. They did all the risk assessment, did everything right, and still these boys died, right? Because if you do adventurous stuff, there's risk. Some people are going to die. And we have got you. You're insured. You're backed. We have got your back. If something happens to a scout when you're here, we have got you, right? We are here for you. Because they're trying to say, look, you do everything you can, but by definition, you can't eliminate that risk, right? And so they every year, if scouting is being done correctly, then every year, tragically, a small number of scouts will die doing a scouting activity, right? Mm. If you don't want anybody to die or get hurt, then stay in the hall and just do like paper mache or something, like whatever, right? Don't play Minecraft.
That's why they play Minecraft, because they can go out and craft their own world and be independent and take on risk in a way that their parents. And then we complain because they're sitting and they want to be on these games all the time.
Exactly. And we also complain that they're not very good at learning the skills of assessing risk and kind of when to take it and when not. But on the other hand, the other thing I would say I don't know how you'll feel about this, but maybe I would, you know, show to your sons, is the work of the Carnegie Hero Awards for civilians. I came across this thanks to Carol Hooven and quoted
in
my book.
I was so incredibly touched by that portion of your book, because I thought, the thing I always argue when, because I want to get into this, like sort of in the new conversation around gender and non-binary and dropping these sort of very cultural understandings of gender, which I'm specifically naming separate from sex, is we are different. Why do men commit all the crime? But I'm doing what I, like what I'm accusing other people of doing. I'm taking just that one version of that, right? Just the sort of manifestation of that that is a cultural negative. And I thought the way you talked about the risk men take often in saving other people's lives, I was thinking about that just 2 days ago with that flight when those men tackled that guy who was going after the flight attendant. And I thought, that's who rushed. That's who rushed forward without thinking about it.
Same with the young guy that Biden actually called out in his State of the Union who tackled that gunman, et cetera. And also, like, if you want to get really kind of visceral about this, what you see is that in kind of mass shooting situations, those tragic situations, the shooter is almost always male.
Right.
It's also true that if there is somebody using their body to protect somebody else against the bullets, they're all almost always male.
Yep.
There's exception is mothers sometimes will do it for their children, but like then you'll very often see that they're kind of the guys are kind of trying, like literally getting them kind of in the way. And the Carnegie Civilian Hero Awards, very quiet organization, basically rewards the people who risk or give their own lives to save the lives of a stranger. It's not their job. So it's not, they're not being paid to do it, and it's not their family. So it's the young men who run into a burning building to save someone, who dive into a river to save someone. And a lot of them lose their own lives in the process. And then they get this hero award. It's a very, very understated operation. They're very hard even to get on the phone, these kind of folks. But I do know that they have looked hard for women.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they just don't find very many women who run into burning buildings to save strangers.
I mean, heck, Cory Booker's done it like twice. He's a United States senator.
So he should get two civilian heroes.
He should get two civilian heroes.
And so look, so this is on the one hand, like 95% of violent crime is committed by men, right? So men do have more potential for aggression and they're more likely to take risks around that for reasons that, you know, are probably ancestral. At the same time, violent crime rates, with the exception of the last couple of years, have really dropped in recent decades. So, and they're very much lower in, say, Singapore than Malaysia. And so the idea that culture doesn't matter is crazy, right? Obviously, right. Whether that tendency to violence is expressed depends on the culture. And in fact, I just came across this, I don't think it was the same CDC survey. It might be, naturally, but there's a showing that the number of high schoolers who'd been in a physical fight has halved in the last 20 years.
Wow.
It's like down to like 20. And I've noticed that with my own sons, right? Yeah. They have not got into physical fights at school. Mm-hmm. And I'm honestly like, really? You know, I feel like I brawled my way through school.
Yeah.
And I just take a step back and I think, wow, that's so great.
Yeah.
That the culture has changed in such a way that they haven't had to learn to use their fists. Right. And there would be some versions of some people would be saying, well, that's the problem in society. You know, men aren't punching each other enough anymore, right, or whatever. And I'm like, what a wonderful world we live in that my sons haven't had to learn how to fight. Right.
Yep.
Great.
Well, but I think what's happened is, though, that we've done that. We've really tried to bring some awareness to the more negative manifestations of masculinity. We're doing the work there. But I think the best argument in your book is that, yeah, but we didn't get rid of patriarchy. We didn't get rid of an organization in our culture and society that sort of has this vision of masculinity. We worked on some of the negative aspects, but we didn't replace it with anything positive. So we're telling men, you should really still be the main provider when the economy changed around them. We're telling them you should succeed at education when the education system is really not built for their brain development. As you're writing this, you do this so masterfully, but I know it had to be difficult to piece apart some of this cultural from biological. I thought the parts you write about, like hormones and how those play out in men and women differently. Not only was I impressed by your, you know, skill at talking about that, but just the bravery, because that is a very, very touchy subject, particularly on the left, particularly with our new conversations around gender and sex.
Yeah, and it's against these weird things where it becomes something of self-fulfilling prophecy that anybody in their right mind doesn't go near these subjects.
Yep.
And what that means is the only people going near these subjects are people who are not in their right mind.
Right. Jordan for Peterson. One reason or another. Lord.
Or take your pick. And yep. I actually mean, Andrew Tate is like
right.
blowing Jordan Peterson out of the water. And Jordan Peterson is he's an intellectual guy, right?
Well, I want you to know that my friend's son, who was intrigued by Jordan Peterson and reading his book, we got him your book and he likes it a lot better. So there you go. Oh,
thank you. Thank you. Well, I also just like there's a tone to these things. So one of the things that happens is that people get angry mm-hmm. because they just feel like their side's not being taken seriously, that these issues are being ignored. And I see that in a lot of men who end up in this space is that they kind of, they get angry. And honestly, sometimes I can understand why, because you can see these examples of just these injustices or these unfairnesses or these double standards. But it's an incredibly unattractive thing to see a guy getting angry on behalf of men.
Yes.
And I approach this genuinely much more in sadness than anger. What I see is just a lot of unnecessary human suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And among women and girls for all kinds of reasons that we can talk about and I think talked about a lot, and among a lot of boys and men that are perhaps not talked about enough, and that's just straightforwardly bad for society if we have boys and men struggling. And one of the moments that sort of stopped me in my tracks along the route to this book was discovering I knew that the suicide rates were higher among men. Mm. I didn't know they were four times higher among men. And even today, I'm amazed by how many people say, are you sure that's right? Because I saw a New York Times piece that girls were having more suicidal thoughts. Or I said, suicidal thoughts.
It's an increase. Yeah. It's also an increase, not a doubling or quadrupling.
Correct. And it's still this massive gender gap. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't worry about the gender gaps the other way around. But yeah, four times higher. But then there's this work by Fiona Shand, this Australian researcher, with this really interesting analysis, a textual analysis of the words that men use to describe themselves in their last notes or posts or whatever before suicide. And the two most commonly used words by men to describe themselves before suicide were useless and worthless. And I thought, actually, of course, that's a particular group. But if as a society, we've genuinely managed to make any of our people feel that way, mm-hmm. that's a colossal failure.
Yeah.
And at that point, it's not a question of race or class or gender. It's just like people suffering. Mm-hmm. And let's figure out why they're suffering and see if we can't help them. And that's absolutely where I come from on this. I don't have an axe to grind. It's just like, for God's sake. If we're allowing our ideological sensitivities or our worries about the tripwires about to get us in the way of speaking truth in a way that could alleviate, even by a small amount, genuine human suffering, then shame on us.
Yeah.
If we're allowing fear of the reaction from some people from really raising the subject to stop us from calling it as we see it. And what I see is a lot of human suffering. And by the way, that's why people like Jordan Peterson and others get such massive audiences, because yep. he just says, yeah, I hear you, you're suffering.
And Donald Trump.
Yes. I mean, just play into that pain.
Yeah.
It's not that it's made up pain, it's real pain.
You probably saw, I was 100% tearing up. I have a half brother that died by suicide, and it was classic death of despair. Just on every, you look that up, and if there was a checkbox, he checked every single one. He was underemployed. He was undereducated. He was suffering with alcoholism. He had had a child. He was not in a relationship with that woman. So I don't think he had a good model of fatherhood. And even my own father at one point during the 2016 election, when we were talking about all this, because he's a Trump supporter, he said on a phone with me, I'll never forget it. He said, I still have worth. And I said to him, hey, I don't think you're worthless. But that's what he felt, even for me. And it just broke my heart. And I thought, oh my gosh. And if you care deeply about issues of race or poverty, well, that just compounds exactly what we're talking about.
We're finally at my favorite time of year. Spring is here. Summer is just around the corner. We're getting our summer essentials ready. Our sunscreen, our emotional support water bottles, our steamy beach reads. But maybe you would prefer your steamy earbuds. This year, there is a new kind of essential right at your fingertips. Enemies to love, chance encounters, a slow burn, friends that become more. Whatever your favorite romantic trope, Dipsy has a spicy audio story just for you. Dipsy is an app full of hundreds of short and spicy audio stories that bring scenarios to life with immersive soundscapes and realistic characters. You can discover stories about second chance romances and adventurous vacation flings. That's my favorite. Hot and heavy hookups. It can be as heavy or as light as you want it to be. This is what I love about Dipsy. It is a modern approach to romance through high quality, captivating audio fiction that you can listen to in the privacy of your own headphones. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/pantsuit. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipseastories.com/pantsuit. That's dipsystories.com/pantsuit.
I recently reorganized my closet and realized that I never need to buy a white blouse or a blue dress again as long as I live. Guys, I have plenty. I did want to add some much neglected color, like pink and yellow, to my closet, and I knew just where to go. Quince always has timeless pieces and a true rainbow of options that can help you build a classic wardrobe no matter the season. It's getting warmer, so I got a soft pink chiffon pleated miniskirt that is so cute, and a really beautiful yellow cashmere tee. It's short-sleeved. It's perfect for the sort of bridge weather we're experiencing right now. And the best part is all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I absolutely love it. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/pantsuit for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/pantsuit to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/pantsuit. Traditionally, financial planning advice is either only for those who are already wealthy or salespeople calling themselves financial advisors who say they'll give you free financial advice but really just sell products to earn commissions. Fearless Finance takes a dramatic departure from either of those traditional models. Their entire business is built on making financial advice accessible and affordable because we know that financial literacy, stress reduction, and financial security are critical to overall well-being. I'm a little bit obsessed with Elizabeth, our Fearless Finance advisor. I've had an array of advisors in the past who answered questions like, should we be spending less on this, with evasive answers like, it depends on your priorities. Not Elizabeth. She answers with actually helpful guidelines. You're spending more than the average family of five, or I'd like to see this increase by 6%. Thank you. This is Fearless Finance's mission, to make advice affordable and accessible. You meet with your planner virtually and they charge you by the hour. You only pay for the time you use down to a quarter hour. Their planners meet with you where you are on your financial journey, no judgment. Visit fearlessfinance.com today. You can chat with a planner for free to make sure it's a good fit, and you'll get $50 off your first planning meeting when you use the code PANTSUIT. That's fearlessfinance.com and use code PANTSUIT for $50 off your first planning meeting. Right after I finished your book, I was reading Dr. King's last book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos and Community. And you should read it. He has a section in there about exactly what you talk about inside the Black community, that we have a very patriarchal idea and a matriarchal reality. Mm. He talks about that in his book.
Really?
He is so naming that. He is naming this. And like, he's not great. Listen, he was a human person at a certain point in time. He's not great on gender. Like, he never even uses a female pronoun in the book, basically. But he names that. He says, like, the idea in Black men's head is that it is hyper-masculine. And the reality, basically, is that the women are the leaders in our community. And that is hard. And I think that's particularly true in lower-income communities, that we have, like, this hyper-masculine idea that pushes back against some liberal ideas that are improvements, like we said, the sort of self-awareness and you know, even toxic masculinity. Like, we have this idea that pushes up against that. And the reality is, like, no one can meet that idea inside the confounds of certain, like, these economic, educational, mental health, addiction. Like, it's just Of course, those are the words people are using before they're taking their own lives.
Yeah. And the way I increasingly think about this is in terms of like a social script almost. It's like, what's the script that we follow? And the good news is that these scripts have become much freer than they were in the past. But nonetheless, I see us tearing up the scripts that my parents had of the dad breadwinner, provider, mum, stay home carer, which is unquestioned, right? Just wasn't, there was, wasn't a discussion about that. It was just like, this was the way it was. And we tore up those scripts and gave women a very powerful new script, which is economic independence, empowerment, you go girl, etc. Very liberating, very powerful, and it's been very effective, and it's wonderful. I love it.
Yeah.
We also tore up the old script for men, which is, yeah, you're going to be a breadwinner and provider, and your role in society is going to be very clearly delineated by that providing and kind of protecting role. We tore that up. No, that's not true anymore, and didn't replace it. And then the result is that without a script, you know, men are left to improvise.
Yeah.
It's haphazard. It's difficult. They have no idea what to do. As this young man said to Peggy Orenstein in her terrific book, Boys and Sex, said, she asked all these young men, what's good about being a boy? What's good about being a man? None of them could answer. And a number of them said, and one in particular said, huh, that's interesting. Yeah, I can't think of anything. Actually, you hear a lot about what's wrong with guys. And I fear that for understandable reasons, we have presented boys and men with a long list of don'ts. Don't do this. Don't say that. Don't look at this. Don't, et cetera. Not very many do's, because do we need them? You know, it's not clear you're going to be needed anymore, by the way, because, you know, the women are kicking their butts in the classroom, doing pretty well in the labor market. So it's like, well, they're not quite sure they're going to be needed. So kind of figure it out, basically. And we've just left them adrift in ways that I think are profoundly damaging to their sense of self, their sense of worth, their sense of value in a society. And I've really changed my mind about things that previously I might have thought of as good or even innocuous, like the idea that the future is female, right? The slogan, the future is female, which is plastered across my kids' high school walls, by the way. And I just started looking at them in a different way and just sort of thinking, you know, because I had all the right feminist credentials and everything. And I'm like, yeah, that's great. The future's female. And then I was like, wait, what are my sons supposed to think when they look at that? And they see the girls killing them in the class, but like, what message does it send to one sex to say that the future is of the other sex? Well, if we said the future's male, well, we wouldn't think that was a great message to our girls.
Mm-hmm.
And it may have been, it had its moment, it had its time, but that time has passed. And now we've got to recalibrate our mindsets for the reality of the current situation rather than 50 years ago.
Well, and again, back to the same point I made with teen girls in the education system, it's not like American women are like, or women in the participating in the workforce all over the world are like, this is paradise. We did it. Utopia. You know, there's this great moment in the TV series about Phyllis Schlafly, Mrs. America. Cate Blanchett plays Phyllis Schlafly. And
yeah, I love that series.
Oh, it's so good. And there's this moment where she was like, I don't want this. Then I'll have to do both. I'll have to do all the home and all the work. And my friends and I are like, yeah, that's the moment. That's it. That's what happened. You know, it's like, it's imbalanced. And I love all your stuff about, you know, we did a good job of inviting women into STEM. Let's invite men into HEAL, into these health and education and learning environments. Because my favorite part that I've been quoting to everyone, because all everybody talks about in my community in a lot of places, is the staffing shortages with nurses and teachers. When you're like, well, we're not going to fix it with just half the population. You're not going to fix a staffing shortage with half the population. And so pushing, you know, men and giving them another vision of what this could look like and what their careers could look like and, you know, their participation in the economy, I think is so important, so important.
And it's part of this expansive model, too. I think this idea of expansion of roles and of possibilities is really, I think that that's really what the women's movement was great at doing, right? It was just expansive. We're just going to add to the roles. We're not really going to take roles away.
Yeah. I used to always say, if you want to vacuum in your pearls, go forth and prosper. Don't tell me I have to. I don't care. All these trad wife peoples on TikTok, go. I don't care. Great. You don't want to go to the gym by yourself? Go with your husband. I really don't care.
Right. This, the glorious thing about a more equal and a more liberal society is that we do get those choices. And that, so we've multiplied the ways in which you can be a woman. Right? I'm not saying that hasn't come with its attendant challenges and risks, and you've talked about that. But meanwhile, actually, I sometimes think we've actually kind of we've reduced the number of ways in which to be a man just when it needed to expand as the role of women into provider. It needed actually so fewer and fewer men in those caring professions, for example. So I have this acronym HEAL, which is the opposite of STEM, and it's health, education, administration, and literacy. So it is teaching, nursing, social work, psychology, etc., and those jobs that require more of those skills, which I'm slightly shocked to discover that most of those professions are getting more gender segregated, not less. So in the other direction, we're seeing medicine, law, science, you know, engineering, etc., getting less gender segregated. Not to say that all of them are where we need them to be, but wow, done pretty good job. The other side, massive gender segregation. And it's happened quite quickly. So even since like, if you go back to 1980, the gender composition of psychology, social work, and elementary and middle school teaching was roughly 50-50. A bit higher, more men psychologists, more like 40% of social workers and teachers, elementary and middle school teachers were men. Now it's 20%. It's halved. And it's dropping like a stone in areas like psychology. Among psychologists under the age of 30, 5% are men.
Dang.
Psychology has just become a female profession. Like in my lifetime, it didn't used to be, it is. And then we wonder, could that be a reason why it's harder for men to seek mental health care? Is it a great idea for all our school counselors to be female? Maybe not. And again, you wouldn't want it the other way around, for sure. But
and with boys feeling divested in the education system, never having a teacher that's male?
The lack of male teachers, again, it's interesting because I've yet to find anybody that will seriously oppose the idea that it would be a good idea to get more male teachers. It's not that there aren't some issues that get raised, but it's now 24% of K-12 teachers are men, 10% of elementary school teachers, and 3% of early years educators are male. And, you know, there's this great line for the women's movement, you can't be it if you can't see it. And this the message that we're sending around appropriate roles is a big problem, I think. But just for the boy, the evidence that it's good for boys, especially in subjects like English, where they're really struggling to have a male teacher. And it was definitely true for me. Like I had an English teacher in high school who was a Korean War veteran and part-time bus driver, a real grizzled old guy. And he would have a class, we were co-ed, but he'd have a class of 16-year-old, mostly working class kids, including the boys, in tears, reading 17th century love poetry. Now try doing that if you're not a guy, right? I just like he was able, and it opened my eyes to literature and to the beauty of words and so on, because I was like, well, if he's into it, right, oh, it's not a girly thing, right? It's and so okay. Just that, and the same, in exactly the same way, by the way, having women teachers in STEM subjects is awesome for girls.
And again, it's also awesome for girls to have an English professor that's doing that, like the grizzled male English professor. Like the three professors I thanked in our first book, or the three teachers I had, one was my high school English professor, who's a man, and it was good for me too. Like if it's good for the boys, it's good for the girl. Like that diversity of seeing what's possible and seeing like different gendered perspectives is valuable. And I think, you know, speaking to this and trying to name it, and then you have this great section of the book where you talk about the mistakes on the right and how they want to turn back the clock. That stuff's easy to write about. But you also have a chapter on the left and the mistakes we make. And I, again, it's not just even avoiding it. It's the way we talk about it. I mean, I do feel like I can hear the emails. My co-host calls it the chorus of 10,000 voices. I can hear the emails being written right now as we're having this conversation. But what about this? But what about this? But what about this? But what about this? As if you are naming suffering around boys, you don't care around the suffering of girls. Or, you know, my younger cousins who are basically really interested in this idea that, like, just gender is a my 13-year-old son, gender is a construct. All of this is a construct. We're harming ourselves by putting ourselves in boxes at all. Let's just, you know, move forward in a way where there is, you know, a spectrum of availability to everyone, which I'm not necessarily opposed to. I think, you know, easing into a more gendered a spectrum of behavior is always beneficial in a multicultural democracy because we have a lot of humans and there is always a spectrum of behavior. But like, how did you work through that?
Yeah, well, the first thing is that, so I agree. And yeah, the emails are being written and I'm getting plenty of those, but maybe many fewer than you might fear.
Well, that makes me feel better.
because I think the appetite for a good faith conversation about these issues is enormous. I'm so pleased by the fact that it, you know, if you frame it in the right way and you just say, look, this is in no way to say there aren't issues facing girls
and
women.
It's not a zero-sum game. We're not picking winners and losers here. I know we are often in society. I get that. But like, we don't have to frame every conversation that way.
We should be honest about where that is the case. And so, for example, I've written elsewhere. Well, I've written for Brookings about the case for quotas to get more women into US politics, right? Mm. The underrepresentation of women in US politics is pretty shocking, frankly.
Yep.
And lots of it, you know, when Mexico is like, and other, you know, are just way ahead of us in terms of gender representation.
It's embarrassing.
It's embarrassing. It's like 25% still. And obviously Biden's done better with his cabinet, but still no female president. And it's like, what is happening to US politics? We really need some sharper interventions, I think, to get more women in. Now, is that zero sum? Yes, because there are only so many of those slots available. Mm-hmm. Does it justify strong action? I think yes, because those are literally the people passing the laws mm-hmm. that affect us. In a representative democracy, they should be representative. So I think there's a huge problem of the gender imbalance at the top of US society, especially in politics. Now, I'm going to talk about how most men in America today earn less than most men in America did in 1979. Mm. Now I'm going to talk about the fact that male suicide rates have risen by 25%. Now I'm going to talk about the fact that the single biggest risk factor for dropping out of college is being male. Now I'm going to talk about the fact that 15% of young men now say they don't have a close friend, five times as many as a few decades ago. Can I talk about that stuff now, right? Because we can hold two thoughts in our head at the same time. We are not creatures of such simplicity that we're only allowed to have one thought or be on the side of one group within society rather than just looking at both, looking saying, well, they're struggling with this and they're struggling with this and let's help with them with that. And in some ways, make it a bit more normal. And my frustration with some of the people in sort of professional politics, right? This is not normal people. It's not normie. it's just this zero sum framing. Yeah. I mean, I think, for example, the White House has a gender policy council, which I criticized briefly in the book, which replaced the Council on Women and Girls. But it doesn't do anything for the gender gaps facing boys. Literally nothing. You read the whole strategy, you read everything I've done. They've just done an update report. I've spoken to some of the people involved in it. So it's like nothing. And so they have an entirely, their view is gender equals women. Gender inequality is the ones that women. Mm. And that's for the right. That's for the conservatives to talk about. And I'm saying to them, you are leaving so much capital on the table. Yep. You are just playing into the hands of the people on the other side who say you don't care about boys and men. Yep. It would be so easy to have a male mental health strategy to look at what's happening. You know, we have a bigger gap on US college campuses today. Gender gap than we did in 1972 when Title IX was passed. It's the other way around. So we passed Title IX, men were 13 percentage points more likely to get a degree than women. Today, women are 15 percentage points more likely than men to get a college degree. So we have slightly wider than Title IX level gender gap in colleges, just the other way around. But the only mention of that in the White House Gender Policy Council strategy is to point out the unfairness of the fact that women have more college debt than men.
Come on.
Oh, annoying. I'm like, come on. First of all, that's just empirically stupid. It's like men complaining that they pay more income tax.
Yeah.
Right. It's just like this. So there's this kind of intellectual just stupidity to it, but it's also just politically. It's like, really? Like, why do you think that is? Oh, it's because there's this gigantic gender gap in terms of who's going to college. And they think the risk is so high, and it's not.
Strategy is dumb because I always think of that. There's a bell hooks quote where she talks about the difficulty of dealing with race versus gender. And she's like, it's one thing to think differently about the people who live on the other side of town. It's differently to think differently about the person that sits across the table from you. Now, that's the inherent challenge, but it's also the inherent opportunity, right? Like a lot of the things when we talk about systemic issues in the United States, we're talking about them. Right? We're talking about them. But not when we're talking about boys and girls. Everybody has a member of the opposite sex in their life. Everybody.
Almost everybody. Yeah.
Everybody, it's hard to find someone, right? Doesn't. I think you'd be hard pressed, right?
Really.
And so like that's the opportunity, right? It's like you don't have to be afraid because everyone, I have a lot of male friends. I have a lot of female friends. I have a lot of parents. I don't have a parent in my life who has not struggled with ADHD. Like either with a nephew or with their own son, like that statistics you have where it's like 25% of boys in elementary school are being treated for ADHD. And it's like, that's really high. Again, it's like the teen mental health. Like if everyone is struggling, then it's definitely not an individual struggle. We're doing something wrong. Don't we want different outcomes? Like I want different outcomes for my boys. Also, I don't want them to go to a college where they're like one out of every four students is boys. Not because I think that that's like it's wrong to be a lot around women, but I think that's hard on everybody. I think that's setting everybody up to have a difficult experience. It's like it's an opportunity here. We're all affected by it.
It is. And that's in just the same way that one of the most powerful messages to support the women's movement was saying, don't you want your daughter to have all the same opportunities and chances to flourish as your son? Like I have, you know, plenty of very conservative people in my family where they all work, et cetera. They want their daughters to succeed. And mm-hmm. if they discover that their wife is being discriminated against on pay grounds in the workplace or harassed or anything in the workplace, they are not going to be happy about that. Right. Mm-hmm. So like the idea that like people don't want women to flourish, but it's partly because it's their daughter, their wife, their sister. Right, who's being discriminated against or harassed or in some way like made to feel lesser because she's a woman, right? Same the other way around. The number of, in some ways, like I think the consumers of my work who I kind of get here the most from are probably left-leaning moms of sons.
Mm. He present.
Right? Who are just like, yeah, okay. If I don't have to give up my prior commitments and I don't have to start frothing at the mouth to care about boys and men, right, and become one of them, quote unquote, then I'm here for that conversation because I'm really worried about my son and I don't think the school system's working. And maybe if we're medicating one in four, maybe that suggests the system's not working for them.
Yep.
Like maybe rather than treating the inability of the boys to flourish in the system as a problem with them, to be medicalized and then treated with drugs, maybe instead something about the setup, right? And again, I think some of this, like it's like one in four boys across K-12 have been diagnosed with some form of developmental disability.
Mm.
Back to your and like the ADHD thing, I think it's crazy to imagine, honestly, that if you have a group where one in four of them have been described as disabled developmentally, come on. Surely,
but not if you think they're just broken girls, right? Like not
if you think they're defective girls.
Not if you think they're just defective girls, and that makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, and
it
that's the thing.
Make sense, yes.
One of the most impactful conversations we had around the Brett Kavanaugh hearing, I said, like, I refuse to believe these beautiful creatures in my house are just rapists waiting to happen. Like, I will not. I will not. No, absolutely not. And that's not to say that, like, the reality of violence with men is not a real one, but, like, this sense of, like, they're just broken and all we can do is put barriers around them. No. No, absolutely not. I don't feel that way about my sons. I don't feel that way about my husband, you know? And that's why, like, the way I calm myself the most is, like, at least he's in their life, like, presenting a different version of masculinity. But, like, that shouldn't be the only option is, you know, make sure you have this very privileged, you know, and luck, like luck meaning the right person to shepherd your boys through this. Although I do think your call at the end for like a different modern reimagining of fatherhood that gives men something to lean into instead of feeling like they're failing constantly is really part of the solution.
And it's back to this like expansion of roles, right? And expanding the great thing about some of the changes we've seen in recent years is it gives men much more space to do more fathering than my father was able to, for example. Mm-hmm. So I was able to be the stay-at-home dad for quite a few years. And that's only possible because of the changes in the labor market, which meant that my wife was able to be, she could earn enough, right, for us to do that. And we always agreed that we weren't going to have two crazy jobs at the same time because we basically wanted to raise our kids. And we kind of took it in turns, and like it was messy, but we kind of figured it out. But it was a great gift to me, right, to be able to just basically be dad for a few years. And that's when I became a scout leader and I was very involved in the community and all that stuff. It was great. Loved it. Slowed my career trajectory down a little bit because that's kind of inevitable. Was it worth it? Absolutely. So you have this opportunity to do more fathering. Meanwhile, there's actually a growing problem of fatherlessness. Mm-hmm. So it's going the wrong way. So we see fewer fathers in some cases. It usually varies by class. But again, one of the stats that makes you go, wait, what? And double check it and then have someone else check it for you and then go to the author and say, are you sure? And then is the following, that within 6 years of their parents separating, a third of American children never see their father again.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, are you sure? Maybe double check. Went back to it. I just wrote that again for another Brookings piece and I had my boss double check it again. Because I thought, yeah, that's right. And I'm like, wait, what? And I think there's cultural stuff here around like fathers mattering in a way that goes beyond the old breadwinner model. There's a danger of like, I was at an event and I laid out the evidence for how fathers are really good for sons and daughters in terms of their mental health and all kinds of things. And someone said, they asked the question nicely. They said, isn't saying that dads matter in ways that are distinct to mothers, although overlapping, distinct, isn't that heteronormative, right? You're applying a heteronormative framework, which is this idea of the binary. And I said, well, look, that's the evidence as I see it. And if the price I have to pay for pointing out the positive impact of fathers on their kids' lives is to be accused of being heteronormative, I'll pay it.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, if that's right, if that does make me heteronormative, okay. Because I think the alternative of saying, well, dads don't really matter. It's not only bad for kids. And here, I think I really got this wrong in the book, actually. It's something I really, like, if I could go back and rewrite the stuff on fatherhood.
Good. That was my last question. So perfect.
I would rewrite it. And I've had this comment for a lot of people, and it's just felt to me like I really missed an opportunity here. The one that I'd like to address in the future is I essentially wrote about the importance of fathers for kids. And I treated fatherhood as a means to an end. And the end was kids flourishing, doing well at school, not getting into trouble, etc. And the evidence for that is very strong. So dads matter for their kids. But I've had a number of men communicate with me and they just have said to me, you know, actually being a dad matters to dads as well. And you've basically said, look, we matter because of all this social science showing that, you know, whatever. But actually the identity of being a father, what that means, maybe you don't have a job or you're struggling in the labor market. Maybe you're struggling with all kinds of other problems in your life. Like, you know, maybe you've lost your faith and you don't go to church anymore. Maybe you are surrounded by a culture that doesn't feel very amenable to you, etc. But you know what? You're still a dad. And I actually met this guy the other day. He was an Uber driver in Charlotte. And I asked what brought him here. And he said, my daughter, my ex moved up here with my daughter. And I didn't have legal rights at that point. So she thought that by moving from Florida to Charlotte, that was going to shake me off. But I just moved my whole life here. I've started working as an Uber driver because I'm not leaving my daughter.
Oh,
I'm going to.
Wow.
So, and I'm like, and it was clearly like his, as a dad, that was going to be part of his identity. And so if I could rewrite that section, and I apologize that I didn't do this, especially to the dads, which is, look, dads, you don't matter just because you're good for your kids and it's good for society and the rest of it. But you have actually, it's good for you.
Yeah.
And that's a noble and important role. And even if I didn't have good social science to say that fathers matter for kids, you know what? You're still a dad and you're still precious to us because of that. That role is so important. So I would definitely write that slightly differently now in a way that was more sensitive to the moral value of just being a dad and what that means and how it anchors you in a way that.
And again, it's like, we're not saying it's positive because it's the only good outcome a child can have and that a child can't have a good outcome in a lesbian partnership. Like, it's just so silly the way we formulate these. Like, they're not mutually exclusive. You can say, hold both things. I see that in my own father's life. He moved far away when I was really little, but he was an excellent long-distance father. And he was very active and remains active in my, you know, twin half-brother's life. And I think I see that when the economy shook him or he got divorced or he did leave, you know, didn't have an active church, like that was important to him. He was and continues to be a very active and involved father. And I thought what you were going to say is that they're not just, and here I'm going to get teared up again, like it's not just when you're a kid, you know, it matters to have a father as an adult, right? Like yes. It's not just like you're done, like, and then sometimes you can just call your mom and you're fine. Like, you just also need that figure as you get older as well.
Yeah, I think that the honoring of dads and fathers at all stages is just huge, right? To any way dishonor them by suggesting that they're kind of superfluous to requirements, surplus to requirements, don't need them anymore. I actually had this conversation with a lesbian couple after I'd been accused of being heteronormative, who, like almost every lesbian couple I know, work incredibly hard to have very strong male figures in their kids' lives, especially if they have sons, right? So they're kind of like social fathers. So again, it's this point, you can do it in different ways. But they're, and I said, look, why do you make such a big deal as a godfather in this case of like, why he's around all the time, he's deeply involved in your kids' lives. I said, like, why do you do that? And they said, because it's really important that they have, like, they don't have a biological dad in their lives, but it's very important that they have dad-like figures, like that they have men who are kind of there for them, role modeling for them, complementing kind of what we're doing. And because they're quite pretty feminist, I said, well, that's very heteronormative.
Oh, that's funny. My co-host always says we overcorrect. And I just think we've done so much overcorrection in the, you know, sort of in the women's rights movement and in a lot of areas surrounding gender and biological sex. And I think we see the manifestations in that suffering. And I think it is so important to name it and say, we're not trying to go back. We're not trying to erase anything. We're just trying to get more on a path where everyone can flourish. That's the goal. Reduce suffering, increase flourishing. And if we see suffering, then it's time to recalibrate. And I think that your book is such important work with regards to that recalibration. I thank you so much for writing it.
Well, thank you for saying that. And thank you for this conversation.
Now tell me, before we leave, the work, you said you're working on a project with boys and men at Brookings. So tell us about that quickly.
Yeah, so I'm staying out on this limb, right? I'm on it. I might as well stay on it.
You're like, and, I'm here.
I'm here now. I've sort of walked through the fire. I might as well keep walking. But also because there is so much appetite from people to say, okay, so what do I do about it? And and the areas I really want to focus on are fatherhood and the way that the legal system, especially for unmarried fathers, can really get in the way of them being involved. And I want to work more on the issue that you talked about a few minutes ago around getting more men into these caring professions, these heal jobs, psychology, nursing, teaching especially. I'm doing some more empirical work on that and trying to push forward on both of those fronts. I think there's lots of other work to do as well, but in terms of making a policy change, that feels to be where I can make the most difference at this point.
Well, great. Thank you so much. Thank you so, so much for your work.
Thanks again.
Listen, y'all, let's be serious. I'm 42 years old. Of course, I take my skincare routine seriously. There are a lot of daily skincare products on the market claiming to help reduce fine lines and wrinkles, but how do you know your products are actually working? Well, Ritual is here for you. They have Hyacera, their once daily skin supplement, clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. They conducted a clinical study and it led to a 3.6 times reduction in crow's feet within 90 days as compared to a placebo and a 2.9 times increase in skin smoothness within 90 days as compared to a placebo. I love taking my Hyacera every day as part of my skincare routine instead of just slathering more products on my face. It feels like I'm doing something from the inside out. And their one daily capsule is essenced with soothing vanilla, so it's a very pleasant experience. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off.
Spring is so tricky because I feel the sun shining, the earth is waking up, and I want fresh, vegetable-forward meals. And I'm running in 75 directions and don't have a lot of kitchen and prep time. Fortunately, Factor is here for me and for you with fresh, never frozen meals that are chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in 2 minutes. They have a ton of options for us, including keto, protein plus, vegan, veggie, calorie smart, and so many add-ons if you need help with breakfast or snacks or on-the-go lunches or beverages. Factor is here for you. Every meal I've had from Factor is so well composed, it's so flavorful, the sauces are delicious, and Factor is celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look for Earth Month Eats badges on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/pantsuit50 and use code pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code pantsuit50 at factormeals.com/pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they made solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
Thank you so much for listening with us. We hope you're enjoying this end of the year season, which is such a good time for reflection and thinking about how we show up and what we want to take with us in the new year. We are so excited to begin a new year with all of you, and we will be in your ears again Friday with another of our listener favorites. And until then, keep it nuanced, y'all.
Pantsuit Politics is produced by Studio D Podcast Production.
Elise Knapp is our managing director. Maggie Pinton is our director of community engagement.
Xander Singh is the composer of our theme music with inspiration from original work by Dante Lima.
Our show is listener supported. Special thanks to our executive producers.
Martha Brunitsky.
Allie Edwards.
Janice Elliott.
Sarah Greenup.
Julie Haller.
Tiffany Hassler.
Emily Holiday.
Katie Johnson.
Katina Zuganellis-Kasling.
Barry Kaufman.
Molly Kors.
Catherine Vollmer.
Lori Ladau.
Lily McClure.
Linda Daniel.
Emily Neasley.
The Hessians!
Tracy Putoff.
Sarah Ralph.
Jeremy Sequoia.
Katie Steigers.
Karen True.
Annika Uvaline.
Nick and Elisa Valelli.
Amy Whited.
Emily Helen Olson.
Lee Shea McDonough.
Morgan McHugh.
Jen Ross.
Sabrina Drigo.
Becca Dorval.
Christina Quarteraro.
Shannon Frawley.
The Lima family!
The Adair family.
Jeff Davis, Melinda Johnston, Michelle Wood, Nicole Berkles, Paula Bremer, and Tim Miller.